If you will join me in the book of Acts, chapter 27. I've been a part of the churches of Christ since I was 5 years old. I was baptized when I was 11, and that was in 1959, so you can figure out how old I am. And yet I've discovered in all these years that we teach on the one hand that all of the Bible is given by God's revelation and is God's Word, and yet we seldom ever hear sermons preached out of some parts of the Bible. Frankly, I've never heard a series on 2 Chronicles. I don't know about you. Don't hear very many sermon series on the book of Revelation. Seems like we end up saving those for Bible classes, where only the so-called faithful few will come and subject themselves to wading through genealogies or figurative language and things that seem to be difficult to understand. We like to spend most of our time as preachers in parts of the Bible that are easy to preach from, so to speak. The Gospels. Of course, that's the greatest material you could possibly work from, the life and teachings and miracles of Jesus. Or the epistles of Paul or Peter and John, where they were actually instructing and admonishing and correcting matters in the churches or among individuals. And certainly there's nothing wrong with that. I've spent most of my teaching career doing that very thing. And yet all of it is God's Word. And we ought to be subjected to all of it. And I don't mean subjected in the sense that y'all are burdened by that and I'm trying to burden you with it, but rather you need to be exposed to it and hear what God saw was so important in every part of His Word, that He saw that it would be preserved through these hundreds and thousands of years. For everything that was written before our time was written for our learning, it says in the Scriptures. And so we're in this part of the Scriptures that is very much history. It's more than history, but very much history. And in this section today, we find that the Apostle Paul at last is able to leave his house arrest, if that's what it was, in Caesarea, after being there for more than 2 years, waiting for some disposition of his case. The Jewish people, the Jewish leadership had brought charges against him. And the Romans had taken custody of him, first of all, just to keep peace in Jerusalem, because a riot was breaking out as the Jews, on the one hand, were trying to kill him and at the very least arrest him. And then once they discovered he was a Roman citizen, he enjoyed the protection of the Roman authorities against the Jews while still having to answer any charges the Jews might bring against him. And so he spent more than 2 years in the palace of the governor in Caesarea, being able to entertain people who would come in to see him, but on the other hand, not being free himself to go and do whatever he might like to do. And when it became clear that his case either was not going to be taken care of like it ought to, or the Roman authorities were going to try to transfer him back down to Jerusalem, where surely the chances were good he would be assassinated, he used his Roman citizenship to demand that his trial be moved to Rome. That was his right as a Roman citizen. And so that is about to begin. He's about to make that trip to Rome. It's hard for us to imagine, or at least me to imagine, what it must have been like to spend more than 2 years waiting for someone else to do their job before you could do anything. In that sense, he was pretty helpless. He couldn't leave and go about what he's done for the last many years of his life. He couldn't do much of anything legally even to push his case forward. It strictly was at the disposition of the Roman government. And he was not a very important case. And it seems that the Jewish people, their leaders at least, were perfectly happy to see him set there. For this kept him out of circulation, so to speak. He couldn't be out converting Jews to Christianity. He couldn't be out spreading the good news about Jesus Christ in other places if he's locked up in a prison cell or at least detained by a Roman soldier in a room in a palace somewhere. And that's what's been happening. But finally, his case is being moved to Rome, and so that means they need to make that trip to Rome. And when we begin in chapter 27, we're going to discover that it was a very eventful trip. It's interesting when you look in the study books and the commentaries and dictionaries and so forth, They often talk about the missionary journeys of the Apostle Paul, and we've in fact gone through those three journeys. But interestingly enough, most scholars call this journey, which is from Jerusalem and Caesarea to Rome, his fourth missionary journey. It's kind of interesting to me because we don't normally think of this trip in those terms. And yet, if we start seeing it that way, we realize that Paul has a tremendous amount of influence on a large number of people during this journey. Now, in one way, it's the shortest of his missionary journeys, if that's what it is, because it's going to take altogether probably about 4.5 to 5 months to make that trip from Caesarea to Rome. Now, normally, that kind of a trip in their day wouldn't take that long. And we've included in your bulletin, if you have that with you, a map of this journey. And so as we read this morning, you can trace the route that he takes and see where these things are happening. But normally it wouldn't take that long to make that journey. But what causes the long travel time is the fact they're traveling at the wrong time of year. The only practical way to make that journey, not just for Paul and one soldier accompanying him, but in fact he's part of a much larger group that Rome is moving from one place to another, was by ship. And during this time of year, which was in the fall of the year, because Luke will say at one place that it was after the Day of Atonement that this trip was taking place, and we know that takes place in about September of our calendar, the winds are going in a contrary direction. And since they're going to be traveling aboard sailing vessels, that means if they're going to travel, they're going to have to hug the coastline as they make their way around as much as possible. And then when they do move out into open sea, the sailors would either have to wait until favorable winds to make progress, or they would have to use a method that involves something I don't know anything about, but basically trying to tack as they go at an angle to the direction they really want to go, but just capture whatever wind they can that sort of will move them in that general direction. And then when you combine that with the fact that fierce storms can arise on the Mediterranean in the fall of the year because of the changing in the weather patterns and temperatures and things like that, just like we see in our spring and in our fall, our worst weather probably in this part of the country, so do they. This trip will end up being much longer and much more dangerous than we would have expected. But he is going to Rome, and he's already been looking forward to going to Rome. He had written some 3 years before this to the Christians in Rome that he's looking forward to coming to see them. But it does seem that at that time he did not anticipate that he would be coming as a prisoner of the Roman government. But I guess there are some benefits. That means the Roman government paid the fare for him. He didn't have to pay it out of his own pocket, but I'm sure the negatives were greater than the positives. During these 2+ years he was in the Rome imprisonment in Caesarea, we know very little about what he did. We don't have much record of that at all. An educated guess might well be that he would spend that time, whenever possible, in communication with representatives from the various churches that he's worked with over the last 14, 15 years. We know that they didn't have a mail system like we do today. It was much more primitive. Certainly no other kind of instant communication like we enjoy today, email, internet, telephone, cell phones, all of that. So communication was much slower and much more primitive by our way of thinking. And yet we have good reason to believe he probably was in contact with the churches that he's not able to go see in person. Perhaps by sending letters to them that we don't have today, and perhaps by representatives who would come from them to him. And then there would be communication and they would go back to him. But another very important thing that seems to be happening during these 2 years he's actually in Caesarea, held in the governor's palace there, is that he probably was involved in an indirect way with helping one of his traveling companions write the first of his 2 books. And his traveling companion is a man by the name of Luke. And the only time we have a record in the scriptures that Luke was actually in the Holy Land, the land where Jesus was born and grew up and taught and did miracles and was crucified and raised from the dead and ascended back to heaven, the only time Luke was in that area was during these 2+ years Paul was in the prison in Caesarea. Luke was not imprisoned. And scholars seem to be universally agreed just about that Luke probably used this time to go back and forth from Caesarea down to Jerusalem into Galilee, finding eyewitnesses, finding source materials from which he could compose what we now call the Gospel of Luke. And that Paul probably was, at least in an indirect way, involved in that process with him, even though he couldn't leave the place where he was detained. A little side note that is very interesting is that over in one of the letters to Timothy that Paul writes at a later time than this, he's talking to Timothy about the fact that those who are leaders in the church have a right to be supported or compensated as they work, if they do it full time. And as he's writing to Timothy about this, he tells Timothy that in the scriptures it supports this idea. And he says, as it says in the scriptures, muzzle not the ox that treads out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his hire. And when he says the scriptures say that, when we start looking for where the scriptures are that say those things, the first one is pretty easy. It's found in the Old Testament in the law of Moses that they should not muzzle the ox that was treading out the grain. As they were threshing their grain, the oxen were used to walk over the grain to break the grain loose from the husk and the stalks and so forth. And by law, they could not put a muzzle on the ox to keep the oxen from bending, you know, leaning over and taking a bite of the very stuff they were working on. And then he says, but the scriptures also say the laborer is worthy of his hire. We search the entire Old Testament and there's no place in the Old Testament where it says that. You say, okay, but he said it was in the scriptures. So you turn to the New Testament. Is it possible that some parts of the New Testament scriptures were already written and Paul was aware of them and had access to them? So you start searching the New Testament scriptures and you find one place where that statement is made other than when Paul said it. And it's what Jesus said in the Gospel of Luke, which clearly seems to indicate Paul knew what Luke was writing and could see it. So he spent these 2 years not in total downtime, but doing something a little different than what he perhaps wanted to. But now he's ready to make a sea journey. And so it says in chapter 27 and verse 1, when it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the imperial regiment. And we, who's the we? It's Luke and Paul and at least one other traveling companion, as we will discover. We boarded a ship from Adramyttium about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. Now this man, Aristarchus, we meet back when Paul was in Ephesus, back in chapter 20 of Acts. Remember when they had that riot at the end of his time in Ephesus and Paul wanted to go in and speak to the crowd, but the brethren wouldn't let him? But Aristarchus did. Didn't solve any problems, but he did. He apparently was a man from Thessalonica, which was over in Greece, but here he was in Ephesus with Paul working. And when this riot takes place, he actually, as sort of a representative or spokesman for Paul, actually goes in to this huge gathering in the theater there in Ephesus to try to address the crowd. He was also one of the ones who traveled with Paul from that region, bringing the gifts of the churches down to Jerusalem. And here he is now, more than 2 years later, still with Paul. Apparently he's attached himself to Paul as a co-worker. In fact, in Colossians, Paul refers to him as his fellow worker. And either there in another passage, he says, and my fellow prisoner. So at some point, Aristarchus ends up being incarcerated along with Paul, whether it's now or at some later time. As we said, traveling by sea this time of year across the Mediterranean in a sailing vessel was a very treacherous thing. And yet, it was something that was necessary to be done. We have to understand a little bit about what life was like in New Testament times in the Roman Empire. The city of Rome had a population of well over 1 million people during this period of time. And it had long since outgrown the ability of the Italian peninsula to feed the city. And so Rome had to pull in huge amounts of grain and oil and wine from all around the edges of the Mediterranean Sea. They had to be constantly being shipped into the city of Rome and its environs to feed those people. And when you study Roman history, you discover one of the things that got emperors into trouble the quickest was not when they raised taxes, was not when they engaged in an unpopular war, it wasn't when they persecuted people of some religious minority, it was when they let the grain supplies dry up. When people got hungry in Rome, that's when they changed emperors. And so something like 400 million metric tons, scholars estimate, of food had to travel into Rome every year. And the largest ships that they've been able to discover so far that traveled across the Mediterranean during this period of time could only hold about 330 metric tons. And so it took thousands of ships every year crossing the Mediterranean loaded with these foods and the basic things for foods headed for Italy and Rome in order to keep Rome supplied. And often those who operated these ships made extra money by selling space on them to passengers, because the wine or the oil or the grain or all of those things, or even other things like metals and woods and exotic materials of other kinds would be in the hold. And so the people would be up in the upper part of the ship and they would sell off space for this. And of course the Roman government itself would confiscate a certain amount of space for their own government officials, including soldiers, and the movement of prisoners and so forth, to do that. And so that's what kind of a ship they've been put on. We will discover later in the discussion that it must be quite a large ship, not just because of the amount of materials that was on board, but the fact that it had 276 people on board. That is a large vessel for ancient times. In fact, it is said by those who know about nautical history that after the Roman Empire collapsed, ships were not built this large again until the 16 and 1700s of our own more modern times. Because these ships in this time had to be built entirely out of wood. And they were pressing the practical limit of how large a vessel you could build out of wood and it still be a practical vessel to navigate. I mean, these aren't barges. These are seagoing vessels with sails and so forth. In spite of the Ben-Hur kind of movies and so forth, most of them were not motivated by men pulling oars. They were moved by sails. And so these were at the very limit almost of what could be built, even in modern times, out of wood. They would make a practical sailing vessel and carry large amounts of materials. This is not the first time Paul's been on board a ship. In fact, again, it's interesting. We mentioned Aristarchus a while ago. 3 years before, when he was still in Ephesus, he wrote a letter to the Corinthians. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he mentioned at that time that he had already been involved in 3 shipwrecks, none of which we actually have recorded in the Scriptures. And he also said that he had often faced the perils of the sea. That means the times when they were not shipwrecked, but they thought they were going to be. Obviously, travel by sea in that day and time was not something any of us will have volunteered for if we could have avoided it. Even today, there's a large sort of industry and science involved in discovering how many thousands of shipwrecks there are on the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. If you ever look at a magazine like National Geographic or even just follow some of the parts that 'll be in the newspaper when you get past the first page, but before you get to the sports page, you know that regularly they find the remains of these vessels from the Roman period of time that sank out in the sea or coming into some of the ports and so forth. And we get a clearer and clearer picture all the time of how big they were and how much they carried and how important they were to the economy of the Roman Empire. And yet the fact they were sunk lets us know how dangerous it was. If you were in the ship building business, you probably had a good business. If you operated a ship line, you probably were in a real crapshoot. You could lose your entire business in almost a heartbeat because of a storm and this ship being sunk. And when they navigated, they mostly navigated by sticking close to shore. The reason for that is very clear because, number one, the compass was not yet being used as a means of navigation. So how do you know where north and south and east and west is? The compass didn't come into use for navigation until around the year AD 1100 or something. So they weren't using those. And even as we see, again, representations of Christopher Columbus sailing to America and others, they're using the sextant. Now that's, I don't know if you realize that. Christopher Columbus invented one of those. It's a kind of way of telling where you are by measuring the angle between where the sun is and where the horizon is. And you can combine that with a compass, which lets you know which direction you're going in. It lets you know where you are on the face of the earth. And the reason Columbus was brave enough to try to sail to the New World, which he thought was China at the time, is that he had invented a sextant that let him know where he was on the surface of the sea. Those were not in use yet. They hadn't been invented yet. And so sailing was strictly a visual endeavor. If it's getting close to sunset, you know which way west is. Just look to where the sun is. If it's right after sunrise, you know which way east is because you look that way. And you sail in that direction. But it's much more difficult, like in the middle of the day or in the middle of the night or in the middle of a storm where those visual cues are not available to know where you are. And I'm telling you all of this because that comes into play into what we're reading here. And Luke tells this story in a wonderful way. It's great literature. It has a lot of the same kind of gripping drama, if you want to say that about it, that reading a fictional story like Robinson Crusoe or Swiss Family Robinson does in the early parts of those stories when they're caught in a storm and are driven by the storm upon a land they don't know where they're at. That's the way Luke writes it. He doesn't give away the end of the story, and so he keeps us somewhat in suspense as we read it. But we do have these little cues from time to time that lets us know that Paul is confident that they will safely arrive at their destination, though there will be many adventures along the way. So let's read some. We've already read that they put out to sea, and if you follow on your map there, you can see what they do. And it says in verse 3, the next day we landed at Sidon. And so when they leave Caesarea and its sea coast and its port there, they travel up the coast of the Mediterranean and put in the very next day at Sidon. And Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so they might provide for his needs. And so already we're starting to see some influence by Paul in this situation, that the centurion lets Paul do what he probably wouldn't allow most of the prisoners to do. Probably accompanied by a soldier, he could actually get off at Sidon, find the church there, and not only greet them, but receive some tender loving care from them for a day or two, ever how long the ship was put in there. From there, we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus. Now, again, I don't know very much about nautical things and so forth, but I did look up what the word lee means for those of us who have that translation. It means to the side of the island that helped them be protected from the wind. Now, if that's not correct, someone can tell me better afterwards, but I think that's what it means. And so they sailed up on the eastern and come around on the northern side of Cyprus so they wouldn't have to go into open water, because this allowed them to be in a little bit calmer winds, a little bit more predictable. And it says they sailed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. So instead of the winds blowing the direction they wanted to go, the winds were actually blowing contrary to that, and in some cases even against them, the opposite direction. And when we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship. This would be a ship that had started out in Alexandria, and that's where its home port was, down on the northern coast of Egypt. And this ship, it says, was sailing for Italy and put us on board. Egypt was the breadbasket of Rome. I've read it and heard that anywhere from a third to half or 60% of all the grain that went to Rome came out of Egypt. And this goes back to the days of Cleopatra and stories that happened all before the New Testament period of time, when that was all set up that way. And so this ship has probably come from Alexandria, loaded with grain already, and it's put in up here on the southern coast of what is modern-day Turkey. And now they've gone on board, and they're going to make their way to Rome this way. Now, who's on board the ship? We've already identified, of course, that Paul and Luke are there, and this other traveling companion by the name of Aristarchus. We know that Julius the centurion is on board. We know there's at least some kind of contingent of soldiers, because later, when the ship is in danger of breaking up, the soldiers wanted to kill all the prisoners. And Julius, their commander, wouldn't let them. So we know there's a contingent of soldiers on board. At one certain point in the story, we will actually hear the ship's owner being named as somebody who's on board the ship, as well as a pilot and a crew. The pilot, of course, being the one who's supposed to know how to navigate through these waters, and the crew would be there to do all the various things that have to do with the operation of a ship as it's out to sea. And so all these people are now on board this Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy. And it said, "We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off Sinaitis. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete." And if you look on your map, you'll see that. It thought that probably they would have liked to have traveled straight west off of Sinaitis, and that would bring them just south of Greece there, and they would just cut straight on over a direct course. But the wind would not allow them to do that, so the pilot makes the decision that they'll go more to the south and hopefully can navigate that way. "We sailed to the lee of Crete opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lacia." And you can see there on the island of Crete where Fair Havens is marked even today. "Much time had been lost." This took them a long time. Luke has already told us earlier that after many days that this had been accomplished. Apparently there's a schedule they're trying to meet, but they're not meeting it. "Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast." And in the NIV it says fast, but the word fast there is actually referring to the Jewish Day of Atonement. This is something both Luke and Paul would have known about and know that it takes place about the middle of September by our calendars. "So Paul warned them, 'Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also.'" Paul, trying to use some foresight about this, not necessarily revelation at this point, he just says, "I can see." He doesn't say, "God has told me." But he says, "I can see that if we continue at this present time, we're likely to lose our cargo, our ship, and our lives." Well, it turns out that isn't exactly correct, because later God will reveal to him what they will lose. "But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix." That's just a little further to the west on the island of Crete, where they had a better harbor and it would be more suitable for staying there for the winter. Because they're now so late in the year, they're going to have to stop. "Hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. And so when a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they had obtained what they wanted, so they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the," and in the NIV it says the northeaster, which really just describes which direction the wind's blowing from. So it's coming from the north and the east. And so that's going to push them more down towards Africa if they go before the wind. Rome is to the northwest, and yet the wind's blowing them at a right angle to where they want to go. "Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the northeaster swept them down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. Now, they didn't carry enough lifeboats for everyone. They carried only enough lifeboats, one, that maybe 10 or 12 people. And you know who those 10 or 12 would be. Let's see. We'll start with the ship owner and then the centurion. You know, so not very many people are going to be, if they need this lifeboat and could be saved by it, only a few would be saved. They had to tie the lifeboat up. Now, until then, usually lifeboats were let just trailed along behind, just tied onto the stern of the ship by a rope. But they have to make it secure. They're afraid they're going to lose that. And so they have to pull it up and tie it up against the side of the ship to keep it from being lost. And when the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Fearing that they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. So they've lowered down an anchor, not that would touch the bottom, but if they came to an area where the water got shallower, it would catch on something and prevent them from being run aground. Even in a ship, if you run aground in hurricane force winds, it's going to totally destroy the ship. So they're trying to use all their nautical knowledge to prevent that. Paul and Luke and Aristarchus, on the other hand, can only just hold on and hope. You know, I have to think they're all seasick in the worst kind of way. How could you not be? It says, we took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. They're starting to try to lighten the ship. Because it was so loaded down with both cargo and passengers, it's riding low in the water, and that makes it a much more difficult ride, as well as slows it down. And so they start making economic decisions, and the owner of the ship is on board to help them make that. What can go and what can stay? And so they start throwing things overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard, so all the extra ropes and pulleys and an extra mast if they had it, and everything that wasn't actually being used on the ship at that moment goes overboard. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and again, that's important because that's what they would navigate with, and they can't see either. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. Luke is expressing his own feelings, as probably as well as that of Paul and so forth. We've already heard from Paul earlier that his fear was that they would lose not only the cargo and the ship, but their own lives as well. And after the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Don't you hate people that do that? That say, I told you so? And the worst part is when they're right. Then you would have spared yourselves from damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost, only the ship will be destroyed. For last night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. Now, if an angel tells Paul, you must stand trial before Caesar, then that means he can't die on board this ship. He has to get to Rome. The angel has promised. Well, what about the other people? And God has graciously given you, the angel says, God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So God has not only promised that Paul will reach Rome and have his trial, but God has promised that none of the people that's on board the ship with him will die. You know, if I'm going to be in a plane crash, I hope God tells somebody on board the plane ahead of time that not only they will survive, but so will everybody else on board with them. Wouldn't you? And that we could have some confidence of that. The truth is, there's probably only about two other people on board the ship who believe what Paul says at this moment, and that would be Luke and Aristarchus. I doubt any of the rest of them believe this, even though they're being told it. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island. On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, the part of the Mediterranean that is south of the boot, as it's called, of Italy. It was called the Adriatic in ancient times. When about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. Remember, they had dropped that sea anchor. Apparently, they realized it's starting to drag the bottom. And that means the water's getting shallower. But it's at night. They can't see anything, and they're still being driven by this hard wind, and it's probably raining terribly, and so visibility is almost zero, even if it wasn't dark. And they took soundings, dropping weights down at the end of ropes to measure when they hit the bottom. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. They're approaching land of some kind. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." Apparently God had actually foretold they all had to stay on the ship. So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Well, Paul just made some more enemies. The sailors don't realize it, but he's actually just saved their life. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, and when I'm on a ship, that's not very much, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. The last thing that goes would be the very reason that vessel is on the sea to start with. That grain, if at all possible, needed to get to Rome. The owner finally makes the decision that even it must go. Because if they can lighten the ship enough, it will ride higher in the water, and as they come up on the land, they can get closer to the shore before they finally scrape bottom and the ship gets lodged there, and maybe they'll be close enough to shore that they can swim ashore. That's the thought here. That's why they're lightening the ship. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land. So now they can see what they already knew was out there. But they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. They can see this bay area and a sandy beach. It's not a port. There's no wharfs. There's no, set up for taking a ship in. So they're willing at this point just to ground the ship and hopefully get off of it with their lives. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail. This would actually allow for greater wind and greater speed as a ship is going to run up against the land there and hopefully get them further up onto the shore. They hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach, but the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. So they didn't make it as far as they had hoped because the pilot didn't know where they were and he didn't know there was a sandbar before you got to the bay. The bow stuck fast, and they would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping, but the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached the land in safety. Now, where are they? They left, if you look on your map, they left Crete and made their way across the Adriatic Sea in probably a very erratic fashion that they couldn't even themselves tell us how they had done it. And isn't it amazing that out in that part of the sea, there's only one small island anywhere around? And it isn't just blind chance that of all the places a ship could go, that it ends up running aground on the one small island that's out there in the middle of the sea. That's God's doing. He's brought them to safety, even though they've lost the cargo and the ship. And that's where our story picks up next time. In all of this, we see Paul's influence is starting to increase. Now, suddenly, the centurion is listening to Paul. The other people are listening to Paul. They start to sense that in some way, God is with him. Remember, Paul had told them when the angel had appeared to him, he says, "Last night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve." Almost surely no one else on board that ship except Luke and Aristarchus, along with Paul, are even believers in Jesus Christ. I kind of suspect that by the time they make it to Rome, there's going to be more Christians in that group. For they will be able to see that God is with these men. God left them in suspense about exactly what the future held, and it wasn't till halfway through the journey He even assures them they will not lose their lives. But even then He didn't give them all the details of what would happen. Probably a great example of what it means to walk by faith and not by sight when we live our lives as Christians. God has a purpose in what He's doing with Paul and Luke and Aristarchus and Julius the centurion. And whether people knew it or not, God actually had a purpose for everybody on board that ship. Just like He does in every one of our lives. There's a purpose. We may not always perceive it. We may not always even accept it if we know about it. But God has things planned for us. We need to be available to be used and to be willing to trust Him to guide us in our lives in whatever way He's communicated to us. And for us, that is almost entirely through the revelation of His Word.